Hello, and welcome to Pitch Sequence, a podcast of the People's Baseball League recorded in New Orleans' historic 7th Ward. I want to start by saying I hope you and your loved ones are healthy and safe right now. I understand these are really difficult times, and just want to let you know my thoughts are with you at this time. The music from today's podcast was recorded around the campfires of the Black Pot Festival in Lafayette, Louisiana, in October of 2019. Today was supposed to be opening day for our league, March 22nd. I was going to read the manifesto, and we were going to do our favorite thing to do on a Sunday in spring, and that is play a game of baseball. We were going to eat hot dogs, drink beer, talk about our off-season programs, discover new injuries, argue with the drunk umpires, and say, "I'm so happy it's baseball season again," over and over. Obviously, that is not happening today, or in the near future, because of COVID-19. I've been thinking a lot about what's important right now. As a social studies teacher, is it important that I continue teaching in whatever capacity I can? It is. I've been thinking about how do we stay healthy under all this current stress with the changes in our lives. And one thing I've learned is the value of a healthy distraction, the value of finishing old projects. So we started this podcast last summer, and I put it aside for several months using the excuse of being too busy. Now I'm picking it back up as a healthy distraction, hoping that you will listen and enjoy. Today's show is about the knuckleball. I sat down with Brady Prosser of Secret 9, Eric Lind of the Creek Street Riot, and Mike Parker of the Rougarou to discuss this pitch that Eric describes as a gesture of wonder. Our conversation is slow and meandering, much like the knuckleball itself, if thrown well. So sit back, open a beer, get some seeds, maybe eat a hot dog, and definitely put a baseball in your hand. Trust me, it's good for you. All right, we are back with Eric Lind of the Creek Street Riot, and we are going to be doing a player profile. So my first question to you, Eric, is how did baseball find you?
Baseball found me from a young age. I was raised in Seattle, and as a young baby, I was taken to Seattle Mariners games with my dad, and that was from I don't know how much, maybe, you know, a couple months old. I was in the Seattle Kingdom watching Seattle Mariners games. And then that just kept up throughout. Then, you know, when I was old enough for T-ball, then I got signed up for T-ball. I played T-ball. Then I played Little League. Then my dad coached. And so my dad was really involved with that and was there coaching through Little League. And baseball is always just part of my life from young age. It was always the most exciting part of the year. And then at a certain point, I moved to Arizona, where baseball became year-round, and then played high school there. And then that's where things ended. Things started to taper off maybe around age 12. Yeah.
Gotcha. So we're talking two very different climates here, Seattle and Arizona, and talking like, you know, athletic activity in these two different climates. Can you talk about that experience? You mentioned year-round baseball in Arizona.
Right. Yeah, and that Arizona also was home of spring training, one of the homes of spring training. So there's a big baseball culture there. And as far as youth baseball, it's highly competitive. So I went from Seattle, which is rainy most of the year, and played for a portion of the summer, where I thought I was a pretty good, you know. I had an ego as a young kid. I thought I was pretty good up in Seattle, and then Then we moved to Arizona, and that was, I think, the first time that I had to embrace my just utter mediocrity. That was when I just realized that I am just totally mediocre at baseball.
So what position were you playing?
I'm still dealing with that myself.
Especially after this last game.
Exactly.
Just the quality of play was so good, and these kids are playing, you know, the club teams and off-season teams, and they're being trained, and there's lots of money in the programs, and
yeah,
it's in that way, competitiveness robs the joy out of what was previously a fun game. And however, it's also elevating it to a standard that I wasn't at before too.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lesson within that the increased competitiveness, then you lose part of the fun, and that's something we're aiming for in the league and still trying to balance. So then you get your license and are able to drive to baseball games.
Right.
In Arizona.
Right. So I'm in Arizona. Even before my license, I had a good buddy who had an older brother, Jared Niska, Justin Niska. We would play ball together. And then he had a license before I was allowed to have. So we were rolling spring training games when I was, you know, basically as soon as I moved to Arizona. And I would go to basically as many as I could. And then I also collected autographs. And so I'd linger, loiter about before and after the games, collect the baseballs, get the autographs, you know, the discarded popcorn.
So you very calculated in your approach to this as far as the autographs and the kind of memorabilia?
Yeah, it was a fun game back then, because I would try to sneak into the places where there was designated places where you could wait for an autograph, which means that your chances of getting an autograph were low. But if you sneak into, for example, like the player's parking lot, where there's no other people, then you have a lot better chance of getting an autograph.
Did the how did the players react to your presence in the parking lot where they weren't necessarily expecting fans? Was it like, oh, just this is a persistent kid, so I'm going to reward him, or was it kind of resentful of your?
I think I got both reactions. Okay. Definitely got both reactions. So, yeah.
Who were some of the more positive reactions from?
Oh wow, positive reactions. I remember that's a great question. I remember Mark Grace, like bigger names. He was always pretty friendly and would always sign, you know, most anything and wait around and sign things. Other players, I remember Ricky Henderson, Barry Bonds.
Ooh, shout out to Ricky Henderson.
Wow. Both live up to their reputation for curmudgeonly personalities. let me think who else. Joey Corr at one point ran over my foot in his car coming out of the Seattle Kingdom.
Wow.
Everything was okay, but that was that was when I was living in Seattle.
Did you? And you I do played with
second
shoe?
Base. I played second base, middle infield too. So Joey Corr for the Seattle Mariners.
What did you do with your shoe after that? Did you?
I didn't do anything with the shoe, but I used the fact that he ran over my foot when you rolled down his window to say, "Hey, you ran over my foot. Can I at least get your autograph?"
And then you were ready for that moment.
Yeah, yeah. And so I got that, and I believe I gave it to you, Mike Parker. You think you're
wow.
Yeah. And, wow. And Joey Corr autograph ball is probably in the collection. I hand it over to you.
Yeah. This is probably going to be a separate topic, but it should be mentioned that a significant amount of Eric's collection has been transferred to Mike Parker, who are both here right now. And that's
which I am very excited about. Still kind of processing, both emotionally and logistically, this cornucopia that I've acquired. I did rearrange some bookshelves, which is a big deal in my household, in order to accommodate some of it. I have a set aside shelf for my baseball books, as well as some of the autograph balls and cards and the some of the little figures that are very cool. Fernando Valenzuela and Brett Saberhagen among them, Gary Carter. And
And that's a whole different part of my relationship to baseball, is that there was an accumulation of material objects that happened from a young age about baseball that I didn't get rid of until fairly recently in my life.
Yeah. An incredible storage and traveling with these things across the country and keeping them in fantastic condition. And so tip of the cap to you for that.
Well, we'll get into that.
Yeah. well, let's move on because that's a whole other topic. But so that kind of covers you through high school age. And then we're just
going to... spring training, right.
Spring training, yeah. And we'll just fast forward to
your... Is that a metaphor, calling high school age spring training?
Baseball in New Orleans. How did you... There's the People's Baseball League. Was there any baseball action happening before the People's Baseball League in New Orleans for you?
No. Baseball had been out of my life for, I think, a good 10 to 13 years straight. Basically, I left it. I went to Arizona State University, stripped from high school, and just stopped playing. Maybe I played catch every once in a while, but it was just full stop. I moved on to other things. And then, yeah, New Orleans happened. And I'm good friends with you, Adam, and with Gabriel Goldstein, who wrote the manifesto for the league and was here from the beginning, and Becky Muma as well.
That episode's coming soon. I'm meeting Gabriel this weekend. It's coming.
And... So there's just a lot of noise about this baseball league that was, or about baseball in general, about playing baseball. That's how the noise started. And then the noise shifted into a more of an organized noise, or a noise for organization, rather. And then that's when the league happened. And I was just, I was there from the early days before it was a league, and we were just sweating it out in the middle of summer for a couple games there. And then I traveled for a bit and took a few seasons off, and now I'm back strong for the start of the season.
And that transitions us into our overarching topic for today, which is the knuckleball, which is a specialty pitch, and it's a pitch that you throw, Eric. And tell us how you came to the knuckleball. Why did you start throwing this pitch?
Right. Well, so in my previous baseball life, before the People's Baseball League, before my 10 to 13 year break, I never pitched. I was a second baseman and shortstop. So I never really worked on pitching or the knuckleball. But, when we were warming up on the sidelines, I'd always just kind of play around with it with mostly a lack of success. But I could throw a lot harder, I think, back then, too. And so then when the People's Baseball League came around, then I could throw strikes from the beginning, but I needed some sort of something, you know, because the strikes are great, but they'll get hit, and it doesn't really match what I was trying to do out there. So I just started working on this knuckleball. So I'd say the basic skill set was always there, but the knuckleball wouldn't have matured and come to fruition if it wasn't for the People's Baseball League. I'd say that the People's Baseball League nurtured the knuckleball, the development of the knuckleball, practicing of the knuckleball, the philosophy of the knuckleball.
And I feel like that also coincided with a plan, a program and a plan that you had. And I believe it was a 5-year plan. Could you tell us about the 5-year plan?
Well, I feel like there should be a bit of a preface that some plan is what do we mean by plan? That I think it was more of an idea. Okay. But I have a tendency to call ideas plans.
Yeah.
And so the plan was to, at some point, you know, I didn't really know where I was going professionally. I thought, wouldn't it be fun to play professional baseball still? So I hadn't given up on the dream, basically, like, you know, that adolescent dream of playing professional baseball. I refused to let that die. I thought, what if I could still have that dream? I thought the only way for that to happen is if I develop a knuckleball, because I can't be able to throw hard enough, run fast enough, do anything well enough at this age, especially because I couldn't compete at that level at high school to begin with.
age are we talking?
Because I couldn't attract the scouts at age 17. Now, I don't know what it makes me think I'll do at 37. But
you know, you describe it, and I remember at the time, I was like, this is sound logic. This totally makes sense to me.
But so the rational side of that was that I thought, this is my only chance. to play professional baseball. And I'd expanded my definition of professional baseball not just to include the major leagues, the minor leagues, but also, say, the professional leagues in Italy, in Mexico, and other countries. And so I don't know how many years, that quote, 5-year plan, I think we're at year 3 right now.
Okay.
Since that was uttered.
So about the midway point.
Is that true?
Since you mentioned it, to any leagues, professional leagues worldwide, are you still available?
I'm available.
You're available. Yeah, okay, great. Yeah. Okay, so anyone listening worldwide, specifically Mexico, maybe Japan, Italy, Eric Lind is available. He threw...
Mongolia.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Australia. I know they have leagues in Australia. You had like 4 innings you pitched this season already, so yeah.
Yeah.
And what I remember the language that we'd use back and forth is whether or not you're on pace. Mm. On pace to make it to the show.
Mm-hmm.
Or a show.
Mm-hmm.
Are you on pace?
Great question. Wow. I would say I'm definitely on pace, but not for the 5-year, being professional baseball. But I'm on pace in certain ways. That the idea back then was that certain things needed to be developed as foundation for the knuckleball. And I had just been getting into yoga back then, and so I thought the foundation of the knuckleball practice is the yoga practice, and that's since been amended a little bit. But because here's the thing is that unlike a fastball or any other pitch, or you can't will a knuckleball. You can't have a demonstrated strength or capacity for a knuckleball. You can do certain things that create the conditions of which a knuckleball might happen. And then once you throw the knuckleball out of your hand, it's up to a certain number of factors, the majority of which are outside of your control as a pitcher at that point. And so that's what makes the knuckleball unlike other pitches, that when you throw a fastball, you work on your mechanics, the different things, maybe in alignment, and you also a lot of power there. And there's technique. And unlike the knuckleball, or the knuckleball is unlike other pitches because not only is technique involved, but also there's this thing that happens when you release the ball that's no longer up to you. It's up to a combination of factors. So, if you're a religious person, let's call that some sort of God. If you're a science materialist, then you look to physics and you say, and there's scientific arguments out there, right? This is why the knuckleball happens. But whatever it is, it's outside of your agency as a pitcher at that point.
Great. Well, let's get into, so to wrap that up, what I was going to, I still think you're on pace to be a professional player, but so, I think you've definitely accomplished being an unprofessional knuckleball
right.
Which anyone in the league can say.
Generally, I'm more accomplished at the unprofessionalization than the professionalization of most things. Yeah.
congratulations, sir. You're an unprofessional knuckleball player in our league. And I think only 2 people, shout out to Illy on the Pelicans. He also throws the knuckleball. He throws a hard knuckleball. But can you tell us a little bit about your knuckleball? How would you describe it?
Right. So, yes. And before I talk about how I describe knuckleball, let me go back up. The previous question is not quite tidied up yet.
Yes.
The about being on pace.
Yes.
Because being on pace is, at this point in the pace of the plan, I've given up timetables. And so it's not a 5-year, it's not a 10-year. Because that's what I realized. You can't impose any sort of external deadline. If the professionalization of the knuckleball is going to happen, it'll happen in accordance with the process of being dedicated to knuckleball practice. So,
do you think that what you were describing as kind of the philosophy of the knuckleball, the kind of non-attachment to the results, do you think that that has affected your kind of relinquishing of the timetable, and how has that affected other parts of your life, do you think?
Being not attached to Well, it's a metaphor for larger things as well. It's also a parallel with what goes on in yoga asana, for example, that you have you can create the conditions for a certain experience, but ultimately what you're doing is stepping back from this idea that you are the doer in charge of the experience. You're the witness of what's being done. And so in relation to that, the knuckleball, like when I pitch for it, it's going to answer the question that I haven't answered yet about how, sure. about my knuckleball, that loop them together here. Is that, for example, breath plays a large part in my knuckleball. And so I only throw the knuckleball on the exhalation or just after the exhalation, the pause between the exhalation and the inhalation. And so I'll exhale, and then that's when my release of the knuckleball is. And I think that that's directly related to the, quote, success of the knuckleball. If the definition of success of the knuckleball is that it unpredictably dances in the direction of the plate and doesn't hit somebody in the calf. that would be a successful knuckleball.
Is that different than when you throw a fastball as far in relation to your breath? Are you also using the same breath techniques for a fastball or a changeup?
I do try and always throw on the exhalation, but I'm much more conscious of when I inhale on the exhale pausing. I learned about that through the knuckleball.
Yeah. I love getting into that. And just the technique of like, when you feel like you're in a rhythm and the batter's in a rhythm, and then you just, mm-hmm. then you just count to three.
And
it's like, and you can see the batter like kind of like, what are they doing? And then you go. That whole game is really fun.
And there's also this, mentally what goes on with the knuckleball, like for example, like the last game I hit, first at bat of throwing to Mike Parker, first pitch, I hit him with a knuckleball in the calf.
Let's talk. This is,
that was like, so, we're not going there yet?
No, we're going there now. We're there. This was a much anticipated at bat. We'd been talking about it. We had, met last Friday and on the first pitch, you hit Mike Parker in the calf with a knuckleball.
And yes.
His knuck, or what's your calf look like right now, Mike?
Oh, it's a little discolored. I didn't feel it much at the time, but then the next day I was like, oh, it's kind of tender. That's but it's really, I mean, we were doing the update about the game earlier, and along with the rest of my team, I think I was just really focused on just finishing that game with a W. It was kind of against the spirit of the People's Baseball League, but we had just been going so long with these close losses, and so. Right after it happened, you said something about just staying in there, you know, just to do the at-bat, and I was tempted.
Yeah, you took your, I'd like to point out, you took your first base. I said, stay in there. I encouraged you to stay in there, but yeah, you didn't. That.
You gave me the option.
I encouraged it.
I was tempted, but given what we've been through, the 11 or 12 run lead just didn't feel secure.
Well, you're playing the Queen Street Riot too, the 12 run lead.
That,
you know.
And then there was also a certain poetry to it.
Yeah.
I thought that, and like I said, you know, in the novel of our. At bats, this is like the first chapter, and so there's a certain kind of offbeat appeal to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you said just a moment ago that in a way it wasn't within the spirit of the league, but I think being hit by a knuckleball in the calf, like very much so within the bounds of what we're going for.
Yes, definitely.
Not that we're encouraging anyone to get hit, but
but it was a knuckleball.
It was.
Yeah.
So let's get back to your technique. We're talking about breath. What about grip?
Oh, right. So the basic things. Yeah, I throw two fingers, and some people will have the knuckleballs curled all the way over, so you're on the face of the fingernails. But I throw mine such that the fingernails are dug into the flesh of the ball.
How many fingers? Two, you said?
Two.
Two fingers.
Yeah. I've experimented with three, and that's a slower knuckleball, but a two-finger knuckleball is what I throw. Yeah.
It's like some things that I'm learning, like a lot of nuanced things. There's a whole language behind it, and you did some research. So what other vocabulary can you give us? So you're saying a two-finger knuckleball. What else do you got?
Right, well, some pitchers have thrown it with three fingers. Some have thrown it with the middle two fingers instead of the index finger and the middle finger. Some throw it with all three fingers. And then again, like I said, the main difference is whether you are of the school where you curl your fingers under or that you poke your fingernails into the ball. Those are the two main schools that I've seen. And then I've never gotten the one to work where I curl my fingers into. I've always, because what you're trying to do with a knuckleball is stop or mitigate spin of the ball. And so the only way that I found out how to do that is to dig my fingernails into the ball. And then there's this, sometimes a strong, finger extension movement that goes on rapidly at the conclusion of your throw. So the fingers extend towards the plate, and that poofing of your fingers towards the plate is what gives the ball its trajectory without spin. And that's on the physics level, what's going on is that you're creating a lack of spin on the ball. And so it interacts with the trajectory of the air in a more random fashion, because traditionally when you throw a ball, there's a rotation on the ball, and that rotation of the ball creates, wave of energy that goes out. But when you mitigate the spin of the ball, it randomizes how the air after the ball passes through the air interacts with it. And so it dances, basically, especially towards the end of the play. What I also learned is that it depends from the studies that determine that there might be a specific relationship with the size and the weight of the baseball compared to how it might otherwise not work. Like, for example, a soccer ball can have the same effect than a knuckleball. Mm. Like if someone kicks a soccer ball, it can have the same knuckleballing effect if kicked in the right way. And knuckleballs also appear in cricket. And so there was a cricket that had a cricket toss with the same sort of intention.
We're just wrapping up here with Eric and some really good stuff related to the knuckleball and the league and life and all that. But one of my final questions to you is the reaction to a knuckleball. What kind of reactions do you get from fans, from your teammates, from the opposing players? What's it like to throw the knuckleball?
Wow. Whose reaction do we start with? So, like, the reaction of Mike Parker getting hit in the calf, yeah. That would be a reaction to start with. That I don't know what that reaction was like, but I had my reaction was, oh, shit, I didn't expect the knuckleball to go that way. and sometimes that happens with the knuckleball. Me as someone that is talked about as someone that throws the knuckleball, my reaction is that there's this, you have to approach the knuckleball with a sense of wonder. Because even I, as the person that's allegedly throwing the knuckleball, I don't really know its final fate. And so if it's working in accordance with the intended effect. And so, my reaction's wonder and like, wow, that happened. And then I try and reflect on, then I dissect, well, why did that happen? Was it actually just randomized? Was it a wind? Was it actually my mechanics that happened? Was it, in the case of Mark Parker, was it my ego got involved? When I hit you in the calf, what was it like to throw a knuckleball? And when I hit you in the calf, immediately my first thought was, oh shit, I hit Mike Parker. And that was like, what? The knuckleball took an abrupt left turn. You're a left-handed batter.
Right.
And hit you in the calf. And if my knuckleball is going to break, it usually does break left, you know, but sometimes it also rises. Normally it sinks. But what happened when I hit you was that I thought, you're coming to the plate. Of all the people, I want to throw a really fantastic, magical dancing star of a knuckleball to. it's you, Mike Parker. And so that was my ego then at the plate when I was winding up and getting in the way of right. that. Because then I was saying, this is the ends that I want. I was prescribing as imposing a set of expectations, what I thought I needed to happen in relation to you. But ultimately with a knuckleball, that doesn't work and it backfires and you end up hitting people or you just, terrible things happen. They go everywhere. What needs to happen is that all that I can be responsible for is my breath, my mechanics, and the set of processes that lead me up to a release of that ball. Then it goes somewhere. But with you, what I'm saying is that what was it like to throw a knuckleball was like, oh, that was me trying to control the knuckleball. And what I've learned from the knuckleball is that you can't control the knuckleball. But if everything goes, so if I offer it with the correct mechanics, the alignment, the launch pad, and with the appropriate gesture of wonder, that oftentimes things work out okay.
So that seems like a good argument for giving up the timetable, because again, the timetable would seem to be kind of an imposition of the ego in such a way that it mm-hmm. could mm-hmm. interfere with the dance of the knuckleball.
Exactly. I can't be attached in any form to being a knuckleballer or being a knuckleball pitcher as a now. I the only thing I can be committed to is a person who practices knuckleballing.
Some reactions that I've observed, it's fun. Like there's an element of fun where people are smiling. So, yeah, when you're throwing the knuckleball as a fielder, when you're throwing the knuckleball, it's really exciting. People want to stand behind home plate to see if it actually shakes. Mm-hmm. And then the added, if somebody whiffs,
ooh, that's yeah.
It's not just a normal whiff.
No,
it's got this added. Oh, and it's
they're really usually off balance.
Yeah,
you know, yeah, it's
slightly humiliating for the batter.
So then, once again, as a pitcher, then boom, the ego gets congratulated,
right?
And so then, what right. happens to that? The next pitch, I generally throw above somebody's head or in the dirt.
Wow.
So that yeah. to be on guard of that. So you know, you're playing with magic here,
right?
This is
right. A little teaser. We thought about doing this as a specialty pitch episode, but clearly there's enough material for just one episode with the knuckleball. But there will be an episode about the ephus, and I think there is some correlation here, though, about, like, there's a joy that the pitch brings to the game.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also just reminded me that there's I do take great joy in if someone just would swing through an ephus. There's a lot of ego involved with that. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, any final thoughts you'd like to add? We're going to invite Brady and Mike to talk about just interesting tidbits about the knuckleball, but any final thoughts?
Well, I'll say it. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks so much for coming on. Dear friend of mine and to the People's Baseball League, Eric Lind, and he'll be going to India soon. So enjoy your time in India. He should be back sometime in December, according to his answering machine. So Brady, you want to come on over?
Sure.
Why don't you start us off with the different names that the knuckleball pitch has?
Sure. We were talking a little bit about that earlier before we started recording, and I was poking around a little bit online, and I have a few. I have an excuse for this. My mom's a librarian, so it doesn't surprise people when they come to my house if they know me to see that I have a shelf dedicated to knuckleball books.
I didn't realize. Canon for wow.
that. Yeah, and R.A. Dickey's book, his memoir, is really good. Yeah. And he's sort of a literary dude, and he follows writers, and he's a good reader. And in any event, one of the better pieces I came across was from 2004 by a writer named Ben McGrath in the New Yorker, one of the lengthier pieces, and I like the way that he consolidated the different names in a paragraph, and among other names besides knuckleball are as follows: knuckler, fingernail ball, fingertip ball, this is a good one, flutter ball, the floater, the darter, the bug. I like that one. The butterfly ball, the moth. That's probably my favorite. The bubble, the ghost ball, the horseshoe, the dry spitter, which was the name. The
dry
spitter. It was called in the early part of the 20th century. The days of Eddie Seacott and the 1908, etc.
Eric, do you identify with any of those names that you just heard? You said dance a lot. You're talking.
Yeah, that's the one that, yeah. The dry spitter is nice. I don't identify with it, but it sounds nice.
Yeah, cool.
Well, there's an element of implied illegality with the dry spitter, and of course, completely legal.
Which, but in the People's Baseball League, all those pitches are legal. No one has really taken advantage of that, so just want to put it out there. Spitballs, screwballs, all that's legal.
Scuffing?
Sure, yeah. I've scuffed a little bit. all right, yeah. What else you guys got? Tell us more about the knuckleball.
Well, in 1944 and 1945, the Washington Senators actually had four knuckleballers as starting pitchers. They had Dutch Leonard, who's the best known of the four, Roger Wolf, Johnny Nigeline, and Mickey Hafner, H-A-E-F-N-E-R. So this was during the war years, and a lot of players were away at that time. So in a sense, it's kind of qualified as far as the relative success of teams. But in 45, with their four knuckleballers, the Washington Senators, who were not known for their success, got to the last day of the regular season before they were eliminated from the pennant. They were looking at the possibility of a one-game playoff with the Detroit Tigers, and Hank Greenberg, who was the Tigers star, who was the first major league player, in my understanding, the first major league player to join the Army after Pearl Harbor, the most prominent Jewish player of the time, slugger for the Tigers. On the last day of the season in 1945, just a few weeks after returning from the war, he hit a grand slam home run to win the pennant for the Tigers. Huge emotional boost. But that meant that we did not have the almost all knuckleball starting rotation in the World Series.
We were saying this, is there currently a knuckleball pitcher in Major League Baseball?
The last one, I think, was Stephen Wright. Okay. With the Red Sox, and I'm not sure if he's still with them or not.
Okay.
R.A. Dickey hung it up in
2017.
Was last with Atlanta.
And
that seems to be a notable trait of knuckleballers. They tend to bounce around teams even more than a regular reliever or whatever.
Right, and the thing that they, like, pitch well into their late 30s and early 40s.
Charlie Huff and Boyd Wilhelm didn't enter the league until he was almost 30, and he lasted until he was almost 50.
Right.
I think he retired at 49. And he's still, I looked up the stat today because I knew that he ranked very high in total appearances. He might have been one, had the record for appearances when he retired. I'd have to look that up. He's sixth right now. And of course, people like Mariano Rivera, they're top five and have passed him by. But he's in the 1,000 appearance club.
And he was one of the very exclusive club of pitchers who had success as both starters and relievers.
Yes. Good point.
I would argue that that of those type of pitchers, you got Eckersley and Smoltz. And I would argue that the other two were knuckleballers, Hoyt Wilhelm and Wilbur Wood with the White Sox.
Good point.
Wilbur Wood at one time held the record for most appearances with 88, and I believe it was 1968 when he was a relief pitcher, and then he was converted to a starting pitcher, and between 71 and 74 he had a run where, all right, his win between 71 and 74, his win loss records were 22 and 13, 24 and 17, 24 and 20, and 20 and 19.
Wow.
And one of those years, 72, he threw 376.2 innings. He threw almost 400 innings, which you see in like the 1880s and 1890s, but you do not see in the modern era. The one exception, one non-knuckleball exception being the year before that in 71, Mickey Lolich, who was kind of a junk ball pitcher for the Tigers, later with the Mets. Mm. He also threw 370. He threw 376 exactly. Went through 376.2 in 72.
Mm. Eric, that bodes well for your professional aspirations because the knuckleball, you have less wear and tear on the arm. That's why these guys pass the ball.
Right, and that again, that the whole philosophy behind it. It's not about aggression. It's not about muscle. It's about these other factors that determine your success.
It's very much a finesse pitch, and
I would argue mental.
Mental.
I wonder if other pitchers would also agree with this, but maybe it's just my own.
The whimsical nature is what attracted me to it, and the unpredictability of it. And
there's things happening that we don't understand.
Yes.
And that can't be said about the case with the fastball or the curveball. That's more predictable. There's things that could be traced back to their cause.
To that point, the great pirate Willie Stargell of Pops called the knuckleball, quote, a butterfly with hiccups.
Butterfly with hiccups. So the physics term that I forgot before was unsteady lift forces. That's the technical physics term that they use to describe what's going on with the knuckleball. Unsteady lift forces, and that just means that what's holding up because of the airflow is it can go at a random nature.
Something or
the butterfly pattern.
Something I noticed with a lot of the more prominent knuckleballers is when you look at their win loss percentage, their career win loss percentage, it's not that impressive. I mean, they lose a lot of games.
There's a lot of knuckleballs that fail.
The hanging knuckleball, or the knuckleball that doesn't shake. That pitch is not a great pitch.
It's an invitation.
Yeah.
Wakefield was not a good postseason pitcher. If you look at his postseason stats, his postseason ERA is like over 6. Mm-hmm. But as far as the big picture goes, he was a big part of 3 World Series winning teams for the Red Sox.
2 wins. And, that's the thing I like about the knuckleball is the resurrection aspect or reclamation or remaking yourself as a player. And Wakefield was saved. They were about to cut him. He was an infielder, and a coach noticed that he was messing around doing toss during a warm-up. He had a killer knuckleball. And the coach said, before you clip this guy, let me want to see what he can do on the mound.
This kind of something I've been thinking about throughout this. When Eric talked about like religion and or whatever your view on life is once the ball releases your hand and how it finally gets to its final destination, that there's, for me, I thought of like hope, that there's this hope that it makes it to where
it
wants to go, but also like you're describing.
It's an act of faith. And reportedly, the Dalai Lama had a killer knuckleball.
I heard about that, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm going to look into that one.
But it's also like with resurrecting a career or in your later years, that there's also this hope that that maybe I can make something of what I've got left. And for me, there's a parallel to that.
Well, that's what Jim Boughton was doing it with his classic book Ball 4. It tends to be remembered for what it revealed about the kind of dark underbelly of baseball that the journalists of the time were not covering. But the subtitle of it has to do with him thinking about using the knuckleball to extend his career. That was a big part of that part of his career at the time. He had had a lot of success, and it had just kind of faded away. And he was with the expansion Seattle Pilots.
he just passed. That always
comes back.
80,
always comes back to the Pilots.
1979.
And yeah. Incidentally, one of the categories for the next round of baseball trivia at Parlo on Thursday, September 26th, will be Jim Boughton / Knuckleballers. There will be four questions having to do with either Jim Boughton or with Knuckleballers.
Now, if you happen to be listening about 30 minutes ago, which good on you for still being with us, we had mentioned that a lot of things had been shifted. Baseball memorabilia had been shifted from possession of Eric Lynn to Mike Parker. You better believe some of that will be available at Trivia next Thursday, September 26th at Parlo Brewery at 7 p.m. That's available. Not to mention the beer. Have you had Trains Across the Sea? What a beer. Love it. Sorry, got carried away there. Any other tidbits, Brady, you got on the knuckleball?
Yeah, a bunch. One thing, I poked around and did some cursory research today, to a primer, a brush up, if you will. And the latest stat that I came across, I wondered how many knuckleballers, how many pitchers in MLB history had relied upon the knuckleball as their primary pitch. And the number that I read was 85, less than 90. And I guess I'd expected it to be a little bit higher, but one of the cool things I think about the pitch is the binding element among knuckleballers. There's almost this sense of camaraderie. The word fraternity is bandied about when you read about the knuckleball, but those dudes kind of tend to stick together and be mentors. So you've seen the knuckleball documentary, which is quite good. You know, of course, Charlie Huff was a mentor, and so was Phil Niekro to these guys, and there's sort of a passing of the torch. The pioneers seem to want to pass off those years of knowledge. I heard one of the pitchers, and I can't remember if it was Hoyt Wilhelm or one of the Negroes, but one of the more memorable quotes was that it takes, you know, a day to learn it, but a lifetime to learn how to throw it for strikes consistently.
But not to mention how many failed knuckleball. I mean, I'm sure there's quite a few in the minor leagues that didn't make it.
A bunch, and there was a guy that I was reading about that I hadn't heard of, but I came across him, and I don't know if it was Deadspin or what it was, but his name was Charlie Zink, and he made one appearance, and Moonlight Graham
as a, love it.
This in this case pitcher, and one appearance in 2008, and gave up 12 hits and a bunch of runs and got a bomb to chase out. But he was actually studying art. He was an art student, and he had washed out of playing community college baseball in California because he was burned out, and it was, quote, too competitive to him. So he moved to Savannah, a town near and dear to my heart. My better half has lived there for many years, and I sort of go back and forth between New Orleans and Savannah. So here he is as a student at SCAD, and he goes out for the Division III baseball team. And his coach is none other than Louis Tiamat from the Red Sox. And they hit it off, and he ended up getting, this kid Zink ended up getting a tryout with the Red Sox and climbed his way up. But I'm not sure why he only lasted the one game, but they're grooming him to be a successor to Wakefield, and Wakefield was mentoring him, but he didn't last. But in any event, there aren't very many of them. And another cool tidbit that I came across is that four of them share the same number, which is number 49, and that is an homage to Hoyt Wilhelm. So the three others that wore number 49 were Wakefield, Charlie Huff, and Tom Candiotti, who's more my era.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
That's great. Is it time to talk about Sid Finch? Are we doing that separately? What do you think?
Well, I mean, we definitely be coming back to Eric as far as getting more into like the yoga and the more kind of spiritual, mystical aspects of it. So I'm all for it. So.
Yeah, who's Sid Finch?
So in 1985, Sports Illustrated, the editors of Sports Illustrated realized that one of their publication dates was going to be April 1st. And They wanted to have an April Fool's article, and I don't know the particulars as far as how it ended up being this particular writer, but George Plimpton ended up writing the April 1st, 1985 article for Sports Illustrated. And Plimpton was a very accomplished writer in these really kind of offbeat ways. He was one of the founders of the Paris Review, which is one of the great literary magazines of the second half of the 20th century. Mm. But he also wrote these kind of immersive sports books. He's best known for Paper Lion, in which he went to camp with the Detroit Lions as a quarterback and wrote about it as a kind of everyman goes to football camp. And it was made into a movie with Alan Alda. Mm. And he did, that was the most popular of the ones he did, but he also did ones that involved baseball and golf and boxing. I think he went three rounds with Archie Moore.
What?
And he did a lot of other things. He was obsessed with fireworks, and he wrote a lot about fireworks. But he wrote a hoax article for Sports Illustrated called The Curious Case of Sid Finch. And the idea was that the New York Mets were bringing a guy into spring training named Sid Finch, who had spent time in Tibet at a monastery, and he had learned how to throw a fastball that topped out at 168 miles per hour. And he had quotes from
168.
He had quotes from manager Davey Johnson. He had quotes from Peter Ueberroth, then the commissioner of baseball. And he had quotes from scouts.
He meant to say it was 138 in the original printing. And then he told that to the editor, and the editor said, no, 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 keep it at 168.
And they had pictures to go along with it. They showed pictures of Mets prospects, including Lenny Dykstra, who had allegedly allegedly been in the cage with him, and they just played it completely straight. They had a picture of a Mets reserve catcher holding his hand after catching Sid Finch because it had obviously been so bruised from the impact. So they played it completely straight, and they fooled a lot of people.
Wow.
I thought it was real, and I remember that. Of course, not going to mark the time because that's the year of the Bears' great season, and I was not a Bears fan, but you'd read that in Sports Illustrated, maybe by Walter Payton and these guys. But I thought it was real, and I was just at that age where I would get fooled by
them. How old were you?
Well, I didn't learn that the Tooth Fairy was fake till I was like 32, so I guess but in any event, my dad was a good sport and didn't ruin it for me. That's one of those things that's like etched in my brain, and it's indelible. I'll never forget being at the dining table in Kansas reading this thing and just eating it up. So he got me.
Wow.
Now, are you just learning now that it was fake?
I think I learned that right after the way, because there was a lot of buzz about it. Everybody was talking about it, and people were like, "You idiot, it's fake." But it read to me like a great short story, and he was coming from that tradition with the Paris Review, which publishes some of the greatest stories that have been written. But in any event, one of the great baseball pieces.
And when I learned about Eric's upcoming trip and how it was related to his yoga practice, that was the first thing that occurred to me. Oh, Sid Finch.
So when you heard the trip, you thought, well, this can't possibly be true. He can't actually be going to India.
Oh, well, I thought he can't possibly just be going for this yoga practice. Obviously, he's going in order to learn techniques that will allow him to perfect his knuckleball to a degree that it will be just unhittable when he comes back.
It sounds about right.
But so tell us about the trip that's coming up and the background to it.
Right, so it's a fascinating story about the Sid Finch, and I had to look it up once. Mike Parker said, "Hey, have you?" You know, he turned me on to the story, and so the interesting part of the story for me is that there was in the hoax, there was this debate that was set out whether Sid Finch was actually going to play. And that debate was because Sid Finch had these other practices and that he was worried that baseball, you know, why baseball? Like, what? There's all these things involved. There's fame, there's fortune, there's ego. And he thought that these things might get in the way of his practices. And so there is this also on the one of the sub narratives of that was that the part that I found fascinating was that there's a large debate of even if this was offered him, this guy that can throw 168 miles an hour because of his spiritual practice and the physical capacities that those endowed him with, that he may just turn that down and go back to the bed. That was the fascinating part to me. And so this is fantasy and when, whoa, but I'm going to India to study, to practice yoga. And I went last year for 2 months and I'm going this year for 2 months. And in my ideal world, I'll continue to go for longer than 2 months. But yeah, it's become part of my annual cycle now. And this is the third time I've gone. And I go up to the northern India to the foothills of the Himalayas at this, I study in the Iyengar yoga tradition. And so I'll be going at a school where is one of my teacher's teachers lives up there and has a certain number of sessions per year. And so I'll be going up there for a while and just doing yoga. Yeah. And then, but like Sid Finch, in relation to knuckleball, like, oh, I have these, I don't know what you call them, ambitions, desires, aims, plans, ideas, all the above.
No cards.
No cards about developing the knuckleball, but since the beginning, my philosophy is that the knuckleball is an outgrowth of the yogic practice. That because of the nature of the knuckle, because the esoteric nature of what's going on with the knuckleball, that if there's going to be any sort of professionalization or development of the knuckleball practice, that knuckleball must be a product of the yogic practice. And similar to the debate at the beginning that I brought up was with Sid Finch was that there is some contradiction there with, like, I ought not pursue a knuckleball career. Because why? Who is pursuing that? Which part of the self is pursuing that? Ultimately, it's the ego part of the self that wants those desires. And so
the part that wants to live in Mexico and play professional baseball?
Right, and beyond Sports Illustrated or ESPN, right, or that sort of thing. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how long have you been practicing yoga?
About 5 years.
Did you have some kind of spiritual practice before that?
I mean, I don't know that these words are, I mean, my degree's in religious studies and philosophy. And so I've always been interested in the ways in which people create and constitute and sustain meaning. However, that's always been a somewhat objective observer perspective. But I've also obviously was drawn to those questions because I'm interested in those questions for myself as well.
And is there a background to that? Thank you.
us a picture?
Video.
What's with the lights?
1 year ago to